Hi, this is Tanya Domi. Welcome to The Thought Project, recorded at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, fostering groundbreaking research and scholarship in the arts, social sciences, and sciences. In this space, we talk with faculty and doctoral students about the big thinking and big ideas generating cutting-edge research, informing New Yorkers and the world. This week's guest, Tony Rowe, is a presidential professor of psychology and biology and director of the Rowe Lab at the Graduate Center. Rowe and his colleagues are investigating the brain's deeply complex cognitive and neuronal architecture and its role in determining our attention, perceptions, and action. Rowe joined the Graduate Center in 2015 after 7 years at the Colin Powell School for Civic and Global Leadership at CUNY City College. Rowe will direct a new master's program in cognitive neuroscience in fall 2018. Welcome to the show, Tony.
Thank you for having me.
Can you begin by explaining to our audience in layperson's language the focus of your lab's work?
Sure. My research tries to understand how the human brain processes sensory information to the point at which we become aware of our surroundings. So my lab focuses on essentially the perceptual processes in our brain that allow us to have representations of things like color or faces, just small objects that appear in our world, and how the brain actually processes that information to the point at which we become aware of that information. My lab mostly focuses on visual perception. It's been estimated that more than half of the brain is involved with processing visual information. We are visual creatures, after all. But we also focus a bit on touch perception and auditory perception or hearing perception as well, and how these different sensory modalities interact with one another, and also how sometimes, in the cases of a condition that's referred to as synesthesias, these different sensory modalities might actually evoke responses in other sensory modalities.
So how much do we really know about this process, and how does it compare to the knowledge of other cognitive functions?
We're actually at a very early stage in our understanding of how the brain functions, generally speaking. But when it comes down to cognitive functions as well, we really have barely scratched the surface. We don't really understand much of what goes on. We've kind of narrowed down some ideas as to what parts of the brain may be involved with some of these processes, but even there, it's becoming much more complex, where there are a lot of interactions between brain areas and ways in which different brain areas communicate with one another to allow us to have these types of experiences and perceptions. So it's a very early on stage of this discipline. It's pretty much vast territory of unknowns. It's like the last frontier in science, as some refer to it as, where we really don't know what's going on, and the complexities of the brain. The complexities of the brain are so large that it's going to take many decades, if not centuries, to even gain some further understanding of what's happening there.
Yeah, and the new frontier is the phrase that comes to my mind as a non-scientist. One of the phrases used to describe this information of gathering and sorting process is the, quote, cognitive and neuroarchitecture. But is there a single architecture, or does the way in which our brains process make sense of this information, does it vary?
I think it does vary. It varies depending on the function that's under question. It also varies depending upon which brain areas are contributing to that function. Some of the same brain areas contribute to multiple functions. So there's a lot of different ways in which these different functions can come about. And in fact, the same brain area, even doing the same function, can signal information in different ways. at different frequencies or strengths of signaling to other brain areas that may convey certain types of information under some circumstances and other types of information in others.
That's interesting, because we might experience certain stimuli, like the waves that are typically interpreted as color or sound, or even how we might even experience emotions. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, there are a lot of individual differences in the way in which people interpret information. So with the same object that's reflecting the same wavelengths of light that should be perceived as the same color amongst individuals may be viewed or seen as being very different. In addition to some individuals, for example, being colorblind, different individuals have different sensitivities to different types of colors, and their general experience of those colors may vary greatly amongst each other. So even though the physical object is the same, the way we see and interpret those objects may vary from individual to individual, and it can actually be quite dramatic in many cases where some people may have different distribution of photo receptors in their eyes that process the information differently, or different sensitivities for hearing. We know that as people age, for example, the higher frequencies of sounds aren't as clearly audible as people who are younger. And so there are a lot of different ways in which that same information can be perceived very differently, or in fact missed altogether by some people.
So what are the the potential medical implications of your work? I've read, for example, that researchers are developing ways to send visual stimuli to the brain through other senses like the tongue or the ears, like you were just mentioning, so that maybe blind individuals would ostensibly be able to actually see. Can you tell us more about this kind of research?
Yeah, so my lab has been actively involved in some of this type of research, and I collaborate with a lot of others who do this type of work. One of the active collaborations I have here at the City University of New York at City College is a computer scientist, Zhigong Zhu, who we've been working together on trying to develop assistive technologies for people who have, for example, visual impairments. And the idea behind a lot of this work is we can use, say, a camera to detect images that then a computer algorithm and some hardware can convert into different types of signals that can be delivered to a person, like through touch, or in another collaboration I'm working on, through stimulation of the brain directly through just little electrodes that you can introduce current into the brain with. So a lot of these different tools that we're trying to develop, these sensory substitution devices or prosthetic devices, may in fact eventually be able to help individuals who have impairments such as visual or auditory. We're working a lot on these types of questions as well.
That's fascinating, especially accessing the sensory nerves of the tongue to be able to hear. That's my understanding. It's possible?
We've tried it with vision. So we've tried to convert visual images into patterns of stimulation that can be delivered onto the tongue using a device that was developed in Wisconsin. But it turns out, actually, that the tongue doesn't have very good ability to discriminate different types of shapes or patterns of stimulation that we put onto it. And so that approach hasn't worked as well as we were at first very excited about and hopeful for. But some of the other approaches that have been attempted are ones in which the brain itself is stimulated by connecting these grids of electrodes, for example, to a camera that can convert the image and stimulate the brain directly, or through some devices that a company in San Diego has been making, where they can insert a grid of electrodes into the eye and convert camera signals into patterns of stimulation on the eye. And in all of these cases, it turns out that our ability to see is much more detailed and fine-grained and sophisticated than any of these devices that we're coming up with are capable of doing. I guess what it really comes down to is that we've had billions of years of evolution, essentially, to form our eyes and our senses in the way that we have them now and are able to do. And our very crude ways of trying to artificially make them aren't really cutting it anywhere near the ability of a normal eye would be able to do. And so so it's been a very large challenge, but it's also been very insightful, too, in terms of just understanding how the brain works, how our sensory receptors work, and how these different types of functions come about in general.
Some of the most interesting work you've done, is it not, in the area of synesthesia and multiple sensory perception?
Right.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, that's been a very active area of my laboratory's research these days. We initially started out sort of coming across this finding, doing a lot of work just looking at multisensory interactions, how touch, for example, might be affected by a visual input. But it turned out that we started testing an individual who had brain damage, and as a result of the stroke she had that produced a small area in her brain that was damaged from the stroke, she developed a synesthesia where she started feeling on the left half of her body different types of sounds that she would hear. And so synesthesia is the mixing of the senses where one sound can evoke, one sensory input can evoke sensations in another. So a sound can invoke touch, or a touch can evoke a visual stimulus. A sound might produce a colored flash of light. So it's all these different ways in which these modalities can get mixed up. And there are many different types of synesthesia. The first one that we studied in the lab was from brain damage. It was an acquired synesthesia. And she ended up having this auditory tactile synesthesia where she would feel sounds on her body, on the affected portion of her body that brain area was normally processing information from. More recently, we've been very actively involved in testing individuals who just have developmental synesthesia or congenital synesthesia. They're just born with it. There's no brain damage there. But in these individuals, it's very systematic in terms of how they experience their synesthesia. What they may, for example, with the letter A, always see a color orange with it. And different letters produce different colors. They may also, for certain sounds, see very specific colors. They may, with certain touches or sensations on their body, may see certain types of visual effects that go along with it. And so there are a lot of different ways in which it comes about. And what we've been doing recently is we've been trying to understand how the brain produces these types of perceptions in individuals. And what we found in the patient was that there seems to be a lot of cross-wiring between brain areas that process these different types of sensory information that kind of evoke responses in the other. And we're currently doing a lot of studies now where we're trying to assess precisely how the wiring and responses in very particular brain areas are driven by information from other sensory modalities.
That's pretty amazing. And given the research that you've been doing in your lab and the research writ large on the mind and brain, now the Graduate Center is going to offer a master's program next fall that you're leading in the cognitive neuroscience area of research. So this is going to be available to master students. Can you talk about that and what people that enroll in this program, what can they gain? Obviously, great research and insight, but What can someone do with a master's in cognitive neuroscience? I'd like to hear more about your thoughts about this new master's program. It's very exciting.
Right. We are very excited about this new program. It was approved on November 22nd, 2017, by the state of New York, and we are now accepting applications for students to enroll for the fall 2018 semester. And it's a very exciting program where students will be able to gain experience doing research in cognitive neuroscience, as well as take fundamental coursework in the cognitive neuroscience domain, including courses in statistics, core courses in neuroscience, and more specialized courses in cognitive neuroscience as well. It's a very exciting time to be at CUNY in the cognitive neurosciences. We just in June of 2017 got our research dedicated state-of-the-art magnetic resonance imaging or MRI scanner at the Advanced Science Research Center. So we can take individuals and put them into this MRI scanner and measure their brain functions as they're doing all sorts of different types of cognitive tasks. And students in this master's program will be able to participate and actually gain experience with this. We also have a lot of other tools and methodologies available at CUNY for these students to gain experience. And we have a lot of EEG systems to measure the electrical activity of the brain during different types of cognitive processing. And this is a tool that neurologists and epileptologists typically use to measure locations of seizures in people who have abnormal electrical activity. But we can also measure normal brain function with it as well. And we have lots of different ways in which we can modulate brain function and disrupt it non-invasively using these different types of tools. So we have the full gamut of resources available to do cognitive neuroscience research at CUNY, and it's very exciting. And so in addition to gaining experience in these tools and methodologies, these students, when they graduate, will be very well positioned to enter into a doctoral program in a specialized area related to cognitive neuroscience, but also get jobs very likely straight out from the program. We teach and do a lot of statistics as part of the research in cognitive neuroscience. We're always analyzing data that we're acquiring, and so these students will gain a lot of experience doing that, and so they could get jobs as a data analyst at various different types of companies. They could also, if they learn how to run the MRI scanner, go off and get a little more training to become an MRI tech, where they can acquire scans at hospitals. They can be also research assistants in other labs. So there are a lot of different opportunities for these students to actually get employment just outside of the cognitive neuroscience area in general.
I want to thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning into The Thought Project, and thanks to today's guest, Presidential Professor Tony Rowe. The Thought Project was produced in partnership with CUNY TV, located at the Graduate Center in the heart of New York City, with production, engineering, and technical assistance by Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz. I'm Tanya Domi. Tune in next week.